Good morning, everyone. We'll open up the Senate Committee on Judiciary. Today we have four bills for public hearing and possible work session. What we're going to do is do public hearings on the first three at the same time. I am assuming that we're going to have individuals who want to testify on all three instead of running them separately. We'll just do them all at once. My understanding is that these will be exclusively for public hearing and that we will not take those three bills at this time into work session. So with that, I'm opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 297, 298, and 299. And Council, why don't you walk us through the three bills as to the summaries, and we'll get started on the testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. These three bills are all from the Humane Society. 297 prohibits a person convicted of sexual assault of an animal from possessing a domestic animal for 5 years. It increases the penalty for unlawfully possessing an animal from an unclassified misdemeanor to a Class A misdemeanor. There is an amendment expected that would change that to a Class C misdemeanor. Senate Bill 298 prohibits returning a forfeited animal to a person in the same household, requires written acknowledgement of the rights and responsibilities of the person receiving the forfeited animal, and 299 allows a court to remove domestic animals from a residence of a person who has been convicted of unlawfully possessing domestic animals. I expect there will be amendments on all three of these bills. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, thank you. I have a panel I'm going to call up for the first panel, then we'll see if there's anyone else who wants to give testimony. Jody Brita, Sharon Harmon, and Lisa Coleman. And Jody, when you get up here, if you could correct my pronunciation.
It's Beretta.
Beretta, like the firearm. But this isn't Guns Day. And we are taking testimony on all three bills. And so, Jody, since you're first, I'll let you go first. And if you want to break them into three parts, however you like to do it.
Members of the committee, I am Jody Beretta. I work for the Marion County District Attorney's Office here at 555 Court Street. I'm here today representing the Oregon District Attorney's Association. We are in support of all three bills. I'll speak briefly about our position. Basically, what these bills would do would be put all of the laws regarding animal abuse and neglect in line with the original intent of the legislature, which was basically just to protect these animals. And that would include putting the sexual abuse of an animal on the list of offenses that would require the offender to not possess domestic animals for 5 years. It also would prohibit people who abuse these animals from having contact secondhand by placing the animal with another member of their household. Again, just to put this law into compliance with the original intent behind just basically protecting animals. It also gives the authority to remove all animals, not just the abused animal, from an offender's household. I think the only way to truly protect animals in our community from people who are known offenders is to implement these changes to the existing statutes. That's all I have.
All right, thank you. What we're going to do is have everyone speak, and then we'll open up for questions. Sharon, do you want to go next?
Thank you, Chair Prezanski, members of the committee. I'm Sharon Harmon, Executive Director of the Oregon Humane Society. We're the state's largest and oldest animal protection organization. We are not affiliated with any national or local organization with a similar name. We are strictly Oregon, right here in your community. Are we speaking, a question, Mr. Chairman, are we speaking about all three bills, or how would you like, because they're all sort of related, but...
Yeah, let me tell you, we have a public hearing open on all three bills, so you can pick and choose how you want to present. If you want to go bill by bill, that's fine. I just figured instead of having everyone walk away, come back up three times, we'd do it all at once.
Your efficiency is greatly appreciated. Thank you. Senate Bill 297 does add sexual assault to the list of crimes whereby if you're convicted, you can no longer own animals for a period of 5 years, as it is a misdemeanor crime. We think that's a very good thing. What we're concerned about was what Senate Bill 297 tries to clarify is by taking it from an unclassified misdemeanor to a classified, and we would offer that it needs to be a Class C misdemeanor, not a Class A, that it fails to provide the protection that other animal protection laws offer. The forfeiture bill, 167.347, allows for pre-conviction forfeiture. If it's not charged as a classified misdemeanor or if we fail to charge, then those protections disappear, and that means the animal has to wait until the case is adjudicated before they can be forfeited and placed into a new home. We all know the case of Vicki Kittles, a notorious hoarder in Clatsop County, where 2 years her 119 animals had to stay in shelters until that case was formally, until she was convicted, then they could be placed. So we want to see that it gets changed to a classified Class C misdemeanor, and we think that will tighten that up. But really what we'd like to see is 297 rolled into Senate Bill 299. Legislative Council's attempt to identify these issues, we've got them all spread out, and we need to make them condensed and make sense out of them. With respect to Senate Bill 299, this again honors the legislative intent to prohibit people from owning animals from having contact with the animal they abused or any other animals. We know that animal abuse is strongly connected to human interpersonal violence. 85% of victims going into a domestic violence shelter will tell you their pets have either been abused or threatened. If people are going to go on to abuse humans, we think they were just as likely to abuse the animals in their homes. So if we could see that the courts have the opportunity to order all animals removed. It's so frustrating to see that pets, you take it away from the husband and it goes back to the wife in the same house. And here's the dog in the same house with the abuser. And I think it's just a little loophole that puts animals at risk and doesn't address what we hope to accomplish. So with the amendments of 299, again, making all these as a person who violates it as a Class C misdemeanor will really help give that clarification and provide the other protections. With respect to Senate Bill 298, this addresses pets already in the home and other pets, and we want to make sure that the residence where a convicted animal abuser resides, they do not have in the home access to animals. So it can't be transferred to a roommate, can't be transferred to a spouse, can't be transferred to a child or any other person in the home. If they're convicted of animal abuse, no pets where they reside is what 298 attempts to enforce. And that concludes my testimony, as confusing as it was trying to do three bills at once.
You did well. We're efficient here. I know it's early in the morning, but we like to just multitask when we can. Thank you for your testimony. I'm going to say Officer Coleman.
Yes. My name is Lisa Coleman. I'm the special agent in charge of the law enforcement
division.
Agent
Coleman.
Agent.
Okay.
Of the Law Enforcement Division at the Oregon Humane Society. And primarily why I am here is to provide more real-life experiences from myself and the investigators that I supervise that have gone out on cases such as these. And primarily from the experiences we have is the impetus to form these bills, especially the one on we've seen many instances where we have found somebody who has been, from a case of ours, convicted of animal abuse or animal neglect. And then we have seen, I can think of three instances specifically, which I've spoken to District Attorney from Multnomah County, District Attorney's Office, in which judges were ordering that the animals could be transferred to the spouse, and as long as the person who was convicted of the abuse said, we're not going to be near the animal, they have granted that animal being able to go back into that residence, into that home. Which has just been very, very concerning to us because of the things that Sharon Harmon spoke about the violence towards one animal, the propensity for the violence towards other animals, the propensity towards violence to humans. So we find this a little disheartening and a little disconcerting that this is actually happening. And I know from talking to the DA that they find it pretty disconcerting as well. And we were hoping that this bill would be an avenue to fix that and prevent that from happening in the future.
Ms. Harmon.
Chair Pozanski, member of the committees, one of the cases, just to bring it more personal, involved two pit bulls that were locked in a shed. We were notified by a neighbor who videotaped the wife coming out holding the infant daughter, her child, and kicking the dog mercilessly, and her final blow, and this was repeated many times over, was to step on the dog's head until she ground the dog's head into the dirt. They had another dog. We were able to get a conviction on the basis of Lucy, the one pit bull, but her brother had to stay in the home. So he went back to being locked in the shed. God knows what happened to him. We went to do a welfare check on him 2 months later, and we could not find the dog.
All right, thank you. I'm going to open up for questions, then I've got some comments. Senator Wissett.
Thank you, Judge Brzezinski. Regarding Senate Bill 297, Section 1, Sub 3, a person who violates this section commits a Class A misdemeanor. It would appear to me that this would change ORS 167, 315, 325, 330, and 340, which are animal abuse 2, animal neglect 2, and animal abandonment, from a B to an A misdemeanor as well. So, I mean, am I misreading that, or would all of those statutes that are listed in Section 1 be elevated to a Class A misdemeanor?
Mr. Chair, did you want me to respond
sure.
to that? That's how I understood it.
Thank you. Second question regards Senate Bill 298. Requires the new owner to execute a document acknowledging that the new owner assumes all of the rights and responsibilities of ownership. What are the definitions of the rights and responsibility of an ownership, and who establishes those?
Our intent, Mr. Chairman, Senator Wissett, our intent going to Legislative Council was to have the person who takes ownership, new ownership of the animal that was abused, to acknowledge that they had the responsibility for the care of the animal, and that's a standard practice in animal shelters. We sign adoption contracts. What we hoped to accomplish was that notification so that they did not, in turn, give that animal back to the person who abused them. And that is in my proposal for amendment to Senate Bill 298, so as not to have contact with the animal in question.
Well, that's, I think if we're going to put this in statute, we either need to define the rights and responsibilities, or we need to lose the words rights and responsibilities, because if we're going to allow just any agency to define what the rights and responsibilities are, it opens a Pandora's box. It's just untenable. And I am a veterinarian, and I have a great empathy for these laws, but we need to make certain that they're written correctly. Thank you.
Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to clarify the intent of the proposed amendment to 297. There will be a proposed amendment that will change the Class A misdemeanor to a Class C misdemeanor. Is that my understanding? Because I believe you testified to that.
Mm-hmm.
Is that okay? And we don't have that amendment yet. Is that correct? Okay.
Yeah. We're just going to do public hearings today on all three of these. All right. Any other questions? I guess a question. I'm kind of perplexed that judges are taking the position that you're saying. I know in the courts that I prosecute in, it is not uncommon for them to extend those type of prohibitions in these type of cases to any animal that's within the house, or the, and also replacing them back into the same house. So I am assuming what you're saying is, or let me just ask, are the judges that are being asked to impose these conditions reasoning that the law doesn't provide for that and that's why they're not doing it, or is it just their discretion that they're exercising and choosing not to do so?
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, I couldn't presume to know what was in a judge's mind when they would give an animal and put it back in the same household. We would like to see the same advanced protections administered in Lane County applied statewide. It's not the case in Multnomah County. It is in Clackamas County, and I think that's the beauty of a well-written and well-thought-out law is that it helps the state be uniform across its borders.
That's all I have. Any other questions? So I will just put this on the record. I always have this opportunity. The first child abuse cases were actually prosecuted under animal abuse back in New York from my days in my first sociology class. So it was pretty interesting that we actually in this country had laws that were protecting animals before we had laws that were protecting children, and they actually had to rely on the animal abuse statutes to actually capture the first child abuse cases that went through court, at least from the textbooks they gave us. So that's the point of history for today, and thank you all very much for being here today. Is there anyone else who wanted to give testimony on any of these three bills, Senate Bill 297, 299, 298, and 299? Not seeing anyone, we'll close the public hearings on those three bills. And Senator Bates, you're here. What I'm going to do is go ahead and open up my work session on Senate Bill 311. Senator Bates was not able to give testimony when we had public hearing before. I've told Senator Bates I would allow him to give some statements for the record on Senate Bill 311. If you'd like to come up, and I believe you may have someone with you. And
Thank you. I got a qualified smart guy with me so that if you have questions I can answer, if he's going to help me out. I think you'll find my comments pretty general and hopefully helpful. Mr. Chair, for the record, Alan Bates, State Senator, and for full disclosure, for those who might not know, I'm also a family physician in my real life, and so some of my comments need to be taken in that context also, period. Mr. Chair, first off, thank you for allowing me to get some things on the record here and to give a few statements. I appreciate that opportunity, and I'm hoping that these may lead to a larger discussion later. I'm going to pretty well keep my comments to the bill, however, as we have agreed, and my concerns about the bill.
And the relating clause, correct?
As related by clause? Yes.
As related by the relating clause?
Yes.
Thank you.
First, I'm going to tell you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm going to give you some congratulations for putting together a tough bill. I have concerns about it, but I am going to support it and vote for it, and I want you to know that. But I want to also express my concerns about it at the same time. First, I believe it does and take a step forward and establish a principle that caps are appropriate in medical malpractice cases. This is obviously a constitutional question. This bill does not solve that question, but it does help establish the thought and the principle that caps are appropriate in medical malpractice, especially for this group of doctors at OHSU. I would point out the doctors at OHSU do not practice medicine any differently than the other doctors across the state. They don't deal with different types of cases than doctors across the state. And so this is sort of what's good for the goose may be good for the gander in the long run. I am concerned about the caps in a very strange way, and I'm going to make some statements you may first think are rather strange coming from a physician. But my concerns about the caps are twofold. One, I'm afraid they're inadequate, even with indexing. I'm fearful that within a year, two, 3 years, a case will arise at OHSU which will far exceed these caps, and it'll go to the Supreme Court, and we'll have the same situation we had before. So that's my first issue. Secondly, the caps themselves are what we call universal caps. They're not just on pain and suffering. They're on economic damages, and they're on medical damages. And strangely enough, I oppose universal caps. I think that those things that are not involved in pain and suffering should not be capped. You can compute what a financial loss is. You can compute pretty well what a medical cost will be for a case as far as that individual is concerned. And to have a cap on that, I think, is something that is a disservice to the patient. As a physician, I refer a lot of patients to OHSU. I am going to have a real dilemma now. Should I refer a patient to OHSU that might have a bad outcome? Or should I refer them to Emmanuel or St. Vincent's or other tertiary care facilities in which that cap does not exist, in which my patient, if they have a problem, will be in a situation where we'll have a better remedy? It also could be in a situation, potentially, since I made the referral, that if the cap is proven to be in place for OHSU, then I might find myself involved in a lawsuit because I made the referral and I do not have a cap on my medical insurance. So it makes a very complex issue for people around the state trying to refer patients to OHSU, as we commonly do. Many of us refer to other institutions in the Portland area from outside this area, so you need to understand that also. The biggest problem, however, that I have with this bill is a missed opportunity. Medical malpractice is a huge problem in our state and across the nation, and not from the area you might consider it. For most physicians, we are focused on what our premium payments are for our medical malpractice, and that's the discussion we usually have. Physicians hate to be sued. They think it is a personal issue for them. But more importantly, as a result of the medical malpractice system we presently work under, they practice something called defensive medicine. And this, for me, is the real problem. If you take all the costs involved in premiums and payouts to insurers and payouts to injured patients and payouts to tort lawyers, you are talking about 0.625% of the health care costs in the state of Oregon, 0.625%. If you talk about medical malpractice, you're talking at least 50, I'm sorry, if you talk about defensive medicine, you're talking about at least a 15% chunk out of the cost of healthcare. Let me translate into real dollars for you. We spend about $20 billion a year in healthcare in the state of Oregon. So we're looking at a huge amount of money in defensive medicine.
Some of that defensive medicine is now becoming dangerous to patients. If you look at the amount of CAT scanning that's going on to patients based on no actual physical need for that patient to have that CAT scan, but the doctor covering himself, and we have a phrase for that which I won't use in public, but you can imagine what it is, we are going to start inducing chest cancers because of that. We have several studies out now that indicate 3 to 5% of all new chest cancers are going to be the result of unnecessary CAT scanning of patients. So we're now not only running up the cost of health care, we're actually injuring our patients because of the medical malpractice tort system we have. So I know this bill could not fix that. I know you were prescribed from going after that, but I just want to get on the record that we need to do more than this bill can do for us in the future, and we are going to start working on that. We did not expect to do it in this session, but we're going to start working on it, and we need to bring that forward. So, Mr. Chair, I appreciate your hard work in the work group getting this bill ready. I support the bill. I will not be shocked to find out in a year or two we're sitting here talking again, and the Supreme Court has once again said the remedy is not adequate. But I will support the bill, and I thank you for your hard work.
All right, thank you. Let me go ahead and just put a few things on the records, and then if there's any questions. Regarding the concern of the constitutionality of the caps, clearly what the work group has actually been able to do was increase the level of those caps. There is a review process that's accelerated that allows an individual to actually contest whether the caps are appropriate or adequate, and it's an applied test. And so there's nothing in this bill that will, in fact, keep an individual from being able to go forward and show that in their particular case, such as in the Clark decision, that the caps, no matter what they're set at, are not adequate for that situation. So there's, the exit or out for those unique and what we hope will be very infrequent type of cases. Regarding the as the Senator Bates, as you said, based on the relating clause, we were in fact limited to dealing with only the Oregon Tort Claims Act. And I hope that your colleagues will consider on the defensive medicine, it goes both ways, based on what you've just told and put on the record, that if someone is actually referring their clients and their patients for unnecessary medical treatment or processes, that in itself could actually trigger some type of liability. So hopefully we can get a better handle on this, And as I told you previously, and I'll put on the record again, I'm more than willing to have that broader, larger discussion in the future. Senator Wissa.
Thank you, Chief Brzezinski. Dr. Bates, could you flesh out just a little bit more the conundrum that it puts you in, the profession in, when you are, on the one hand, protecting yourself from specious liability claims by doing a great deal more testing than you otherwise would, and on the other hand, being held liable for doing too much testing to protect yourself?
Well, you're obviously, Mr. Chair and Senator Whitsett, you're obviously in a no-win situation. Right now, most physicians look at it from this point of view. If I do everything, I am in a better position if I have to be in court. If I do less than everything, it might potentially put me in jeopardy. And that's the attitude they have. If you're in a situation where doing too much can get you in trouble or doing too little gets you in trouble, pretty soon you're in a situation you can't practice medicine anymore. So it's one of those things that's a catch-22. You're damned if you do and damned if you don't. I really think that we need to change the culture of this system. Medical malpractice is there to protect patients. It's to help drive us, hopefully, towards better care of our patients. This system is only doing that in a very cursory way and not the way we really want it to. And there's better systems, there's better ways we can deal with this, and that's a discussion for a later time. But we need to move forward in this.
Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Senator Bates, for your comments. I just wanted to clarify. You made some comments about CAPS being appropriate in medical malpractice cases, and the task force was dealing with the Oregon Tort Claims Act, which doesn't just apply to medical malpractice cases. And so I just wanted to clarify that I share your concern about the CAPS may be found inadequate, and as Chair Brzezinski stated, there is the expedited review process, but we heard a lot from local government. If we had had the CAPS higher for many of their issues, they would have been too high for them to be able to insure. So we weren't just dealing with medical malpractice cases. We were dealing with all governmental immunity issues under the Oregon Tort Claims Act. So there is a distinction. If we were starting from scratch, in a perfect world, maybe we would have done an analysis based on the nature of the injury rather than the nature of the governmental body. And I raised that point a couple times during the discussions, but that's not where we were. So thank you for your comments.
Mr. Chair and Senator Bonamici, thank you for your comments. I am fearful you're going to find the same problem across the board in this, and I realize what those premium rates look like for everybody, and that's an issue that we also have to deal with. I am concerned by the number of cases you might be seeing going to the Supreme Court. We'll wait and see. If we have case after case after case going up, then we know we have to go back and tweak this. But we'll look at that a later time.
I think we will, and I think we'll actually see as these cases, just like any new law, that is going to be tested or challenged in court. Once the court starts giving us a little more parameters, we'll see exactly how many, let's say, additional type cases we have. I think the last thing I just want to follow up before we close this part of the work session is that the local entities did in fact bring forward the concern that they had some type of predictability as to what the risk would be. What they also showed is that in the quote-unquote everyday run-of-the-mill type of tort claims, the numbers that have been proposed in this bill should be more than adequate for some time in the future. And as you mentioned, with the indexing there, we hope that they will keep pace on the non-medical malpractice cases with inflation, realizing that exponential cost in the medical malpractice area is something that we really can't legislate.
Mr. Chair, I couldn't agree with you more. I think that caps that are indexed have real value, and the one thing you said was certainty. And it's really important to have that certainty going into the future when you're looking at your premium rates, because that's the one thing that insurers seem to be most concerned about, is not the size of the cap so much as the certainty of what those caps look like. So I couldn't agree with your statement more.
All right, thank you. And I'm assuming there is nothing else to be put on the record at this point. Thank you very much. With that, Council, thank you all very much for being here and being available.
Why don't you go ahead and walk us through the, I believe it's the dash sevens.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. You have before you the dash 7 amendments to Senate Bill 311, which we heard on January 22nd. I tried to do a hand engrossed amendments for you. I don't know if you found that on your desk. I couldn't do it with the my number, so I don't know how helpful it would be. But basically, the dash 7 amendments, they add special districts and other nonprofits to the definition of local public body for the purposes of the Act. That was the dash 1 amendment we saw on January 22nd. It clarifies the direct appeal language. That's section 6 of the new section 6, I believe, of the language. It applies the caps to all torts covered by the OTCA, including wrongful death and other statutory torts. That's the effect of adding the not on the first page. And an adds language clarifying the retroactivity. The parts of this go into effect for claims that were December 28, 2007, the date of the Clark case. So if there's any further questions, I'd be happy to try to answer them. Right now, we do have a revenue statement. We have no revenue impact, and we have a fiscal statement that's been issued. It's indeterminate.
Mr. Chair, Anna, can you please go back to the not on page 1? I missed the purpose of that addition.
That actually, if you remember, let's get the bill out in front of us. It's lines 10, 11 on page 1 in the original bill, Senate Bill 311. What we had in the original language was claims subject to ORS 30.260, the 30.300, are subject to the limitation imposed by ORS 31.710. That talks about, it references wrongful death and other statutory torts that weren't the subject of the Clark decision but are subject to the Oregon Tort Claims Act. So when we add the not in there, according to legislative counsel, those wrongful death and those other statutory torts do are going to be under these same caps, and that's consistent with the whole. It's all the Oregon Tort Claims Act. It's not just the Clark decision that we're talking about. It's not just common law. It's the statutory torts and the wrongful death.
Is that a change from existing law?
It's change from existing law only to the extent. Change from the existing law. Yes, it is a change from the existing law.
Let me just clarify. My understanding is a change in the sense of bringing up to the levels of the that will be under the Senate Bill 311, all these other torts that are under the Tort Claim Act that weren't specifically addressed during the drafting of the stuff that's more geared to the other non wrongful death caps.
So in other words, the new caps will apply to those as
yes.
well.
That's correct.
So they're not
so
under the old 200,000.
Yes.
Okay. Understood. Thank you.
All right. Any other questions? Chair will entertain a motion regarding the dash 7 amendments.
Mr. Chair, I move the adoption of the dash 7 amendments to Senate Bill 311.
Senator Alamichi moved the dash 7 amendments into Senate Bill 311. Any discussion? Any objections? So ordered. And the chair will entertain a motion regarding the amendment bill.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 311 is amended with the dash 7s to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Bonamici moves the Senate Bill 311 as amended by the dash 7 amendments to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Discussion? Okay. Senator Boquist.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to echo or agree with many of the things that Senator Bates brought forward, and given the fact that It is related, but not in the related clause of this. You know, the Oregon Health Fund Board, you know, has identified the whole medical malpractice tort reform issue as an issue, and I remain concerned about that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Senator Wissett.
Thank you, Chair. I'm still concerned about the Section 21 that repeals the distinction between economic and non-economic damages. That's a deal breaker for me. I think it's a little more, in my opinion, a little more than an open season for tort lawyers, and I believe that it's going to grossly increase the cost to the taxpayer for settlement of these things. I think we're going to see a lot of them, great many of them, inflated through the non-economic damages and then settled out of court, and it's I hesitate to use the word extortion, but I mean, that's the kind of what it looks like to me, so I will be a no. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Senator Baldacci.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to make a couple of comments that may differ from those of my colleagues. I'm going to be supporting the bill, but as I've mentioned before, in a perfect world, I would rather see caps based on the nature of the injury rather than on based on the governmental entity that's responsible. I think if someone is hurt by somebody working for the city, to the same extent that they're hurt by somebody working for the state, they should be able to recover the same amount, and they don't under this bill. But in the spirit of compromise, I understand there were reasons why we placed the caps based on the governmental entity rather than on the nature of the injury. I agree that there should not be a distinction between economic and non-economic damages, because particularly people who are retired or non-working homemakers and that type of thing, who may not have the same ability to show lost income and that type of thing, I think should be able to recover their damages. And I think that doing away with the distinction is not going to result in more lawsuits. And what I discussed in one of our previous meetings on this issue is if there are many more cases, to the extent of the injuries that Jordan Clark suffered at OHSU, we should be talking about it in the healthcare committee, not in the judiciary committee. Because if there are damages to that extent, that's a healthcare problem, not necessarily a tort cap problem. So I applaud you, Mr. Chair, for shepherding this bill through its process. And I know it's been a challenge, so thank you.
Other comments? All right. We have a motion before us now, and those who are, I think this one will do a roll call. Let's just do a roll call.
Senator
Bonamici?
Aye.
Senator Baldacci?
Aye.
Senator Dinkelman?
Aye.
Senator Whistler?
Nope.
Vice Chair Bogus?
Aye.
Chair
Prudnancy? Aye. The bill passes to the floor with a due pass recommendation. The chair will carry, and we'll talk to Senator Bonamici, since she also was part of the work group, as to her participation. We'll close the work session on Senate Bill 311, and we're going to go ahead and open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 403. And, Council, when you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 403 allows beneficiaries to a wrongful death action to agree to distribution of damages rather than requiring the distribution through interstate succession. Declares emergency effective on passage. We received the fiscal impact right before the meeting. There's no fiscal impact, and we have no revenue impact. This one's ready to move if the committee so chooses. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Chuck Tallman.
Thank you, Chair Krasanski. My name is Chuck Tauman, T-A-U-M-A-N. I'm a lawyer in Portland, and I'm here to speak in support of Senate Bill 403. My testimony will be very brief. I've handed you a one-page, more or less, a technical review with all of the statutory citations on that, so I'm here really to make a more general statement quickly and answer any questions. This is a small bill, as opposed to the bill that you just finished discussing that affects probably every Oregonian potentially. This is a bill that will affect just a few, and in particular, it affects a family that I represent along with other lawyers in Oregon, or in Portland. This is the Williams family, and the current law under wrongful damages distribution, in other words, this is how the money, once it's recovered by settlement or by
judgment, how that money is distributed, requires that the proceeds be distributed by something called intestate succession, which is dictated by statute. And in this case, where there is a surviving spouse and children, adult children, 100% of the proceeds would go to the surviving spouse and nothing would go to the children. Now, in many cases, this is an adequate distribution, is both fair and good public policy. But in a situation like this, where the surviving widow is elderly and the children are adult children, there is a provision under current law that allows the beneficiaries to all agree on how the proceeds should be distributed. In other words, something that gets them out of a restrictive and arbitrary distribution dictated by the Oregon intestate law and allows these beneficiaries all to agree, and they all have to agree. In other words, if one of them dissents and is not willing to agree, then the fallback is the intestate distribution. But at least it puts the decision making in the hands of the beneficiaries of the wrongful death case. Now, these are cases by definition where the person who's in a position to do estate planning has his or her life has been taken away wrongfully, and they are not in a position to do the typical estate planning that might be done by you and I looking forward to a normal full life and then with concern about our surviving spouse or others, our children. So basically what it does is it takes there is an exception under current law that allows the beneficiaries to agree, but for some reason when it was drafted it did not cover the type of damages that are involved in this case. It focused on an exclusive type of damages. So this bill would simply broaden that to allow any proceeds of whatever description resulting from a wrongful death case to be distributed in accordance with the wishes and the specific agreement of the beneficiaries. I'd be happy to take any questions.
Senator Baldamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to clarify, Mr. Tomlin, all the other damages in a wrongful death case, the beneficiaries can agree. But for punitive damages, which is what we're talking about, they can't agree. And this would just make punitive damages in the same category. Is that correct?
Chair Prozanski, Senator Baldamici, that's very close to what it is. There is a class of damages that under current law, the beneficiaries can agree, and that's just one specific class of damages. I can go into detail about those descriptions. This would broaden them to include all classes of damages, which would include punitive damages, as in this case. So what it does is it takes an exception that has very limited application and broadens it to include any type of damages, including punitive damages.
And a follow-up?
Yes.
And could you explain, the beneficiaries don't receive all of the punitive damages, is that correct?
No, that's correct. As I'm sure all of you know, under a decades-old Oregon law, in the case of punitive damages, the law states that 60% of those punitive damages are paid directly to the state of Oregon. And then in addition, punitive damages are taxable under the income tax laws, and so the recipient of the punitive damages would have to pay Oregon income tax on the 40% or the percentage of the proceeds that go to the beneficiary. And then in this case, since the widow is elderly, once the widow passes and the money then would go to the beneficiaries, those beneficiaries would have to pay a third set of taxes, which is the Oregon estate taxes on any proceeds that are passed in that way. In addition, because of a ruling by the U.S. Supreme Court, which particularly disadvantages people in this type of case, the beneficiaries of wrongful death proceeds also pay income tax on the portion of their
recovery that is paid to their lawyers, which seems particularly unfair. Of course, the lawyers have to pay income tax on their own income when they receive it, but so there's already a double taxation built into this aspect of this type of case. So it's particularly difficult in this type of situation. I'm here to plead, I guess, on behalf of the Williams family, but also other families that are in this type of situation.
All right. And Chuck, let me just clarify my understanding. This really is just another tool for beneficiaries to use and how distribution could occur. And as you said, all the descendants that are in the position to receive it must agree unanimously. If they don't, then the game's off, go back to the intestate division. The only other one I think we want to put on the record is if there's a challenger to the distribution, I'm assuming that they also would basically cloud this type of use of a tool and would have to go through some type of court proceeding as to their legitimate right towards some type of distribution.
Yes, Chair Przanski, that's exactly correct. Any person who claims to be a beneficiary would have to have that adjudicated, and then if all beneficiaries did not specifically and exactly agree on a distribution, then this exception would not apply.
All right. Thank you. Any other questions? Is there anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on Senate Bill 403? Not seeing anyone coming forward, we'll close the public hearing and we'll open a work session on Senate Bill 403. The Chair will entertain a motion.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 403 to the floor with the Ducasse recommendation.
Senator Bonamici moves Senate Bill 403 to the floor or makes a motion to move Senate Bill 403 to the floor with the Ducasse recommendation. Any discussions?
Just a quick comment, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I'm not sure I fully understand it, especially now that I see it's the Philip Morris case, but considering it's a tax issue, I will be supportive of it.
It's a means of allowing those who have the right to the money to, let's say, circumvent some of the current tax structures that we have.
Mr. Chair, pay what is due and no more.
Right. All right. Any other comments or thoughts? Any objections to the motion that's before us? Not seeing anyone, passes to the floor. And Senator Bonamici, if you'll be so kind to carry this one.
I will do that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And Council, what else do we have going on for today?
I think we have finished for today.
And tomorrow, are we on for 8:30?
We are on for 8:30 tomorrow.
All right, so we're adjourned for today. And my understanding, we are scheduled for hearings tomorrow starting at 8:30. Thank you.